This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. So here's a question. Can you help solve a crisis and profit from it at the same time? It's a question that comes to mind at this so-called tiny home village in North Hollywood, a relatively new kind of homeless shelter. Now, looking around, you see rows of what look like small sheds painted different colors. There's 75 of them all together, but this makeshift campus is only one of nearly a dozen villages like this to pop up all around LA in the past few years. And all of them are supplied by one company, a for-profit startup in Washington State called simply Pallet. Well, Pallet isn't the only company making tiny homes, but they have cornered the market in Los Angeles and in cities all across the country.
From 2019 to 2020, we had 7,000% growth in demand.
That's Pallet founder and CEO Amy King. So what's behind that massive growth? And what does it say about the future of this crisis of the unhoused? KCRW reporter Anna Scott picks up the story from here.
Every business story, in one way or another, is about supply and demand. Demand for safe places to sleep in LA is overwhelming.
You don't feel it until you hear it.
When Steve Mason lost his housing a few years ago, it didn't sink in right away.
When people go, hey, you look like you're homeless, you know, it's like, not really. But the bottom line is, if you have to turn that corner with that cart and figure out where you're going to sleep, it's real.
Mason is one of more than 40,000 people unhoused in the city of L.A., and the city doesn't have nearly enough shelter beds for them all. It's easy to see why tiny homes, as they're known, have caught on as a way to boost that supply. They can be assembled in less than an hour almost anywhere. Mason moved into one about a month ago. It is tiny, 8 feet by 8 feet, but offers privacy, AC, and heat, and it stands on a secured, fenced-in campus of sorts with restroom trailers, meals, and social services, overseen by a nonprofit called Hope of the Valley. Their CEO is Ken Kraft.
It's amazing what happens when you treat people with love and dignity and respect and give them the basic human needs that they deserve.
To Ken and many city officials, the proliferation of tiny homes is a story of supply at last matching the urgency of demand.
This is a long overdue emergency response to a humanitarian crisis.
Others see a different story, starting with the term tiny home.
We refuse to refer to a tool shed as a tiny home.
Pete White is the executive director of the Los Angeles Community Action Network, a Skid Row-based advocacy and community organizing nonprofit.
The thing that's really interesting about the tiny tool shed strategy is that I think many people don't know where it came from.
He's referring to a court case that had a lot to do with fueling the tiny home craze, or let's say tiny shelter for the sake of compromise. In 2020, a group made up of mostly downtown business owners and residents sued the city and county over encampments and conditions on the streets. City officials recently settled and agreed to build thousands of new shelter beds.
We find ourselves now in a place where there has been a backpedaling away from anything akin to permanent housing and moving forward quickly towards shelters.
And that, he argues, is more about sweeping unhoused people off sidewalks and cracking down on street camping to appease housed constituents than it is about solving homelessness.
The only thing that solves this crisis is housing.
City officials like L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti say they know permanent housing is what solves homelessness, and they're building that too. But it's slow, and what's in the pipeline isn't even enough to meet the demand. And in the meantime, the situation on the streets is untenable. And this brings us back to the business opportunity. Pallet CEO Amy King says she saw a chance to do well by doing good.
So we wanted to create something that would sort of fill the gap for people so that the streets didn't become a waiting room while people waited for housing to be built.
The company, which employs formerly unhoused people, sells its 8x8 tiny shelters for about $7,000 apiece, mostly to municipalities like LA, who then set them up largely on publicly owned land and hire nonprofits to provide services. Throughout 2020 and 2021, Pallet lobbied the LA Mayor's Office, the City Council, and other departments on homelessness policy, and the marketing paid off. Besides becoming the go-to company for manufacturing these shelters in LA, Pallet recently raised 50 $15 million from a half dozen investors to expand its business. King says the investors care as much about mission as the bottom line.
More than a return on investment, they are looking to me for things like, are we getting people into work and getting their wages up? Are we helping them get into permanent housing?
The individuals and funds who invested, King says, are the types who also get behind things like green technology. There is a big difference, though. With green technology, they're banking on a transition to cleaner energy, a solution to a crisis. With tiny shelters, investors are banking on cities building out their shelter systems as homelessness continues to be a massive problem for the foreseeable future.
I will be very happy to celebrate the day that we shut the doors of this shop because our product is no longer needed.
In North Hollywood, Steve Mason says he's grateful for his tiny shelter, but ready to get out of it.
I've been homeless for a long time, and it's my time to move on to trade one of these gorgeous tiny homes to someone else less fortunate than me and move on.
But because of LA's lack of permanent affordable housing, a typical stay in a tiny shelter can run anywhere from 4 to 12 months. And this waiting room is about to get more crowded. Now that many COVID restrictions have been lifted, some city council districts are starting to require 2 people per 8-foot by 8-foot tiny shelter. For KCRW, I'm Anna Scott.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, back now with more of Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. If you found yourself on Beverly Boulevard of late, going toward downtown near the First Street Bridge, you may have seen a grand new addition to the historic Filipino Town neighborhood, a 30-foot-tall arch that stretches across the boulevard, welcoming you to the neighborhood. Well, it joins other welcome signs and archways to neighborhoods and cities all over Greater LA. Think Chinatown and the Big Dragon, or maybe the NoHo Arts District on Lancashire. Officially named the Talang Gabay, our guiding world or our guiding star, the historic Filipino Town Arch was designed by artist Eliseo Silva, whose design evokes LA's rich Filipino history. And Eliseo Silva is here with us right now to tell us more about his work on the arch. Eliseo, welcome to you.
Hi.
And Jessica Coloza, the former commissioner on the LA Board of Public Works, helped spearhead the project. She's with us here as well. Thank you for coming on, Jessica.
Thanks so much for having us, Steve.
I understand you and the community worked on getting this arch built for quite some time. How long did it take and why was it so important to you?
It's a labor of love for nearly 2 decades, and the community has been advocating for more visibility, for a marker that really shows our history, our culture, and highlights our contributions to Los Angeles. And it really started after then City Council member Eric Garcetti designated this neighborhood that we now know and love as historic Filipino Town. And so there is a Western gateway that was also designed by Eliseo that marks the Western end. And so this Eastern end was so critical to us because this is a focal point of what you see heading into downtown. And you mentioned the First Street Bridge, and that's literally what this gateway is. It's not only the largest in the city of Los Angeles or even the state of California, but it's the largest Filipino monument in the entire country. And it's going to bridge the culture of the Philippines, of Asia, to LA and the rest of the country. And we really have to give credit where it's due to our incredible artist, Eliseo, for his vision. And of course, to the mayor and council member for their support in getting the funding in place for this.
What finally got it over the hump? I mean, how did y'all manage to finally get it pushed through, Jessica?
A lot of the momentum came from the community. They wanted to make sure that, especially in a time when Filipinos and the Asian community have been so impacted by the pandemic, we know that, for instance, a lot of our healthcare workers are Filipino nurses who have disproportionately, unfortunately, passed away due to COVID-19. And at the same time, the community, the broader Asian community, is experiencing a rise in anti-Asian hate. Over 10,000 incidents nationally have happened. And so there is this sense of not feeling safe in your own community within the broader Asian community. And that is not the message that we wanted to send in the city of LA. We wanted to make sure that all of our communities, Filipino, Asian, immigrant communities, don't just feel welcome, but they feel celebrated, especially in our public spaces. And with a partnership and incredible leadership of LSAO, we put together a beautiful design that represents the beautiful history and culture of the community.
LSAO, do you want to describe that design? What did you put into that? How much of the cultural flavor of the Philippines and historic Filipino town here in LA? How did you sort of put all of that together, and what does it look like?
Yeah, thanks, Steve, for the question, and thanks, Jessica, for the background on the project. One of the things actually that is symbolic in the gateway that is connected with the Filipino mural I did way back in 95 is that the idea that the Philippine sign of the flag used to have a face, a human face. But during the Americanization period, as some of you know, that the Philippines was under American rule, and the human face of the flag was removed, was erased. So literally, we didn't have an identity because we were Americanized. And so we are having this movement of trying to tell our stories by putting a human face. So that's one of the things I made sure that's in the Philippine sun. And I made sure from the beginning, I made that point with Jessica that as long as you put the face on the Philippine sun, I'll be happy, you know, because that for me completes the message of the mural and the gateway. It's kind of connected that way. But for the structure, I looked into the pre-colonial Filipino palatial structures, which is called Maginoo House. Maginoo is the word for nobility, and it's built like ships. And a lot of our ancestors are seafarers because we are an archipelago of over 7,500 islands. So the boats actually have motifs of birds on the mast of the boat to symbolize the birds as their guiding star.
Jessica, what's left of the Filipino presence there in historic Filipino town these days? I mean, are there restaurants? Are there still people of Filipino descent living in the neighborhood?
Yeah, no, there is a huge presence still. There's also a lot of Filipino-owned and Asian-owned businesses in the area. One of the pieces that I like the most about the gateway, in addition to all the beautiful design elements that LSAO just mentioned, is that there's actually a QR code on a storyboard that's wrapped around both columns of the actual gateway. So you can go there, take out your phone, scan the QR code, and it'll take you to a webpage hosted by the Department of Cultural Affairs. And there you'll be able to read more about historic Filipino town. You'll see and learn more about other investments the city of LA has made into the community, from the World War II Veterans Memorial to the beautiful mural that was painted by LSAO at Unidad Park, to a few other key landmarks. And then we also included a list of some of the Filipino and immigrant-owned businesses in the community, because we are also wanting to make sure that we highlight small businesses in the community and that people patronize them and support them.
With this new visibility, Jessica, what do you want people to take away from the arch? I mean, are you hoping it'll attract more folks, a better understanding of the Filipino impact in LA?
Absolutely. I hope that people see it and realize how much Los Angeles is championing immigrants. The Gateway is about embracing, highlighting Filipino and Asian culture, but really it's about highlighting and celebrating all immigrant communities. And that's why Los Angeles is a global city and is so unique, because we don't just have a historic Filipino town. We also have a Chinatown and a Koreatown and a little Tokyo and a little Bangladesh, because these communities are key parts about who we are as a city, because we benefit tremendously from these communities, whether it's from healthcare and Filipino nurses to the Latino community and how much they uplift the local economy in Los Angeles. All immigrant communities in LA are a big part of who we are, and that's what this gateway is a testament to.
I want to thank you both for coming on and talking about it, and it really is a sight to see. Jessica Colozzo, former commissioner on the LA Board of Public Works, who helped bring the arch to life. Eliseo Silva, the artist and designer of the historic Filipino Town Arch. By the way, we have pictures on the website at kcrw.com/GLA. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks so much, Steve.
It's KCRW's Greater LA, and on to a different place in LA now. This one, a solo exhibition from the artist Kevin Beasley. It's called On Site, and it uses a lot of different media to explore the Black experience and how that experience has shaped American history and culture. Now, to do this, the artist uses ordinary materials and personal artifacts like his own clothing to make his art. And to tell us more, our art insider, Lindsay Preston-Zappas, is here. She's the founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Lindsay, hey!
Hey, Steve!
So as the name suggests, On Site is a show that looks at the idea of place, right? On site.
Yeah, exactly.
Describe how Beasley does that in the exhibition.
Yeah, I think it's a theme that the artist has been really leaning into in recent years. He's begun to introduce raw cotton into his work, and this is actually sourced from his family's intergenerational cotton farm in Virginia. So, you know, here he's thinking about his own personal history, but also the histories of the slave trade and cotton manufacturing. And then he also uses things like clothing to refer to specific memories and personal details. So in this show, you see these house dresses kind of repeated across the works. And this refers to these house dresses his family used to buy from a specific store in Harlem. Or you might see do-rags, t-shirts, clothing scraps. And he sort of uses these to create his compositions, which he calls slabs. So to build these, he builds them actually face down, kind of front to back, and he layers in the clothing, and then he fills in this raw cotton around that and kind of builds up a 3-inch surface. And then he'll pour resin over the whole thing into this frame, and it kind of sets everything up and hardens it. And only then can he kind of demold it and see what he's done. It's kind of a mystery until it's unmolded.
Wow.
So he's layering these pieces literally as he makes them, but also I think there's a metaphorical layering of these items and materials that hold significance to him and you know, specific places and spaces in his own life.
It sounds very three-dimensional, right?
He's
layering, right? I can imagine. He's incorporated sculpture and drawing and installation, and he's got some sound and music and performance into the show as well. Why so many things?
Yeah, again, you know, that layering, thinking of that process of building the wall pieces, I think that comes into play here with the sound and installation and sort of layering a more dynamic narrative. A recent project that he did, which I think is significant here, he actually purchased land in the lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans and planted a community garden. And then he also installed a utility pole there that's very similar to the one that's in this show here in L.A., and the pole had streetlights on it and working Wi-Fi, and it was the only hotspot really in the neighborhood. So it really, you know, benefited the community. And so he's definitely thinking beyond the walls of the gallery space. And, you know, this show included a lot of wall works that do feel very suited for a museum or gallery exhibition. But he's also using sound and installation and these other elements to really point outside of the gallery space and connect to this broader narrative of place.
Of place, the lower ninth, but of course in New Orleans, but also, you know, using his personal effects. And I'm wondering, you know, was there one specific work that stood out to you?
So for this show, he's using this new process called dye sublimation, and he uses that to print photographs onto T-shirts that he uses to create his wall panels in that process I described earlier. But what this has allowed him to do is to include personal photographs that, again, connect to his family history. So he's printing sections of images directly onto the front of kind of like store-bought white blank T-shirts and then layering them to kind of puzzle piece the image back together.
So not only personal effects, but also, as I mentioned earlier, and as you mentioned earlier, sound, right? He takes, like he does these field recordings, and he gathers them from different locations. How does that affect the full experience, Lindsay?
Yeah, so at the center of the gallery is this huge utility pole installed. There's two LED streetlights that kind of span off of it. There's a cooler that I assume was used at the opening for drinks, but I'm not totally sure, and a bottle opener. There's a utility box and a fan, a pair of Nikes hanging off one of the poles. And then strung from this pole are wires that really span all of the several galleries in the space and various speakers. And I was told there's even two up on the roof. And each of these speakers play a different field recording that the artist took from different sites that are meaningful to him.
Wow. Why do you think he's getting his first solo show in LA right now?
You know, the Gallery Regan Projects just started representing him, and I think it really speaks to momentum that he's had in his career and that he's been building, which includes a lot of kind of notable East Coast exhibitions. And then the project I described in New Orleans also kind of gained a lot of critical attention for the artist. So I think he's at a really interesting point in his career where people are watching him. He's getting, you know, museum shows and galleries to kind of notice him. So it's really exciting to have him picked up by this gallery and to kind of be involved in more West Coast conversations in the future.
Well, the exhibition is up through June 25th over at Regan Projects, the Kevin Beasley exhibition. Lindsay Preston Zapp is founder and editor-in-chief of Carla. Lindsay, as always, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. Check us out at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. And you know what? While you're there, how about throwing some support our way? It is the final week of KCRW's Spring Pledge Drive. What's that? You didn't know we've been fundraising. That's no accident. We're trying to be as least disruptive as possible, but now we know there's a deadline looming, 1 week, and people who are really stepping up. The Hillenberg family is on standby to give KCRW $25,000, but only if we can inspire you to give and help us get to that 25 large by midnight tonight. That is 50K on the line. Don't let us lose it. Think about the station. Think about what it is you get from this radio station when we transport you out of LA traffic with a song, a story, or a segment, a program. We have lots of new merchandise to check out. Again, kcrw.com/give. Thank you for your support. 800-600-5279. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ears. Have a great day.